There's an infinite number of monkeys out here. The one thought was about the strip for Hamlet they work out.
Welcome to Create and Resonate. And today we are blessed to have Elizabeth Wardle. Now, I've got a stack of details about Elizabeth, and it's very, very impressive. But Elizabeth, would you like to give the audience some a synopsis, as it were, of you, who you are, and why you are extremely esteemed as an academic and a writer?
Sure, Lee. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the invitation, especially from all the way across the world. So I talk about myself as a writing teacher first, before anything else. I have a PhD in rhetoric and professional communication. I have been teaching writers and also training teachers of writers for 20 years now. I teach at Miami University in the English department, and I run the Howe Center for Writing Excellence at Miami University also.
And you, if I'm right in thinking this, you've written lots and lots and lots of books on writing, but there's one in particular that caught my eye, and that's the one that you wrote as a textbook, which is now is it about 400 in tertiary institutions now that it's been taken up by. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because some of my audience are creative writing students. They're doing a master's or, you know, whatever in creative writing. So can you talk a little bit about that particular book?
I would love to. The first thing to know for your audience of creative writers is that it is not a creative writing book. So I teach and study all the kinds of writing that are not really thought of as creative writing. So I think about professional writing, technical writing, everyday writing. And for many, many years, I have really thought that the way that we, especially in the United States, go about teaching students to write in college has not worked. All the research backs us up on this. I think the United States is actually pretty different from all the other countries in terms of how we do this. So if you have an Australian audience, they might be interested in this. So in the US, we have since 1875 been basically requiring all first year college students to take a class called first year composition. And we have somehow imagined that if every student took this class, they would sort of get a writing inoculation and then be able to write forever and all time anything they may ever need to write. And we obviously know that just by common sense, that does not work, that all of us learn to write by writing and getting experience and writing new things in new contexts. But that's a very particular sort of thing that happened in the US, because in the late 1800s, Harvard started giving an entrance exam that all of the students failed. And so they panicked and said that American boys were illiterate and they needed to do something to sort of give them a remedial education. And that's where this class came from. And so we've inherited that. And as you can imagine, it has not done what it was supposed to do. And so what I did with my colleague Doug Downs is really think about, well, if you have this space in the curriculum and you know that what it has been asked to do is not realistic, what could you actually do with this space? And so what we sort of argued was that what students need to know in their first year is how writing works, all the kinds of writing they might be asked to do, what they might do as writers to learn to write effectively in different contexts, but that there is not a class that can actually say, we're going to teach you how to write every single thing you'll ever write. So that's what that book does. It's called Writing About Writing and is now in its fifth edition. It's used all over the US as well as in Canada. And last year, a school in India started using it.
I mean, are the students themselves given access to that book so that they can pick up some of those details, or is it just for faculty members?
Oh, it's a student, it's a textbook, it's for students, absolutely. And so it really is a book that says to you as a student, here are some things you need to know about writing. And the way it begins is to say, think about all of your experiences with writing and all of your experiences with writing in school and all the ways you've been frustrated and enraged and maybe not even served very well by those experiences. And think of all of the questions that you now have about writing. Maybe you've never stopped to think about them, but you have questions about writing. And so this book will not just tell you things, but help you explore the questions that you have. So I'll just give you an example. One of the first years that I taught using this method, I just asked my students, what happened to you in high school in your writing classes? What are you unhappy about? And what questions do you have? And one of the students said, I want to know if my teachers actually use all the rules that they made me learn. And I said, that's a great question. That's a research question. Let's design a research project so you can find out. And he did. So he actually wrote down all the rules his teachers had taught him. Then he reached out to all his high school teachers and said, could you send me samples of your writing and also tell me, do you abide by these rules? And of course, the answer was no, because what he was learning was very rigid school rules about writing that don't actually work very well in the world. So that's sort of what the class does and what that textbook does.
That's brilliant. With that idea, then, have you over the last 20 odd years of being involved with writing as such, have you noticed a change in ability to be able to write? Because certainly over here in Australia, we're seeing the unspoken, well, we're not allowed to talk about it, but we've seen the dumbing down of writing. A lot of students these days find it incredibly hard to put an essay together, for example, for college or tertiary institution. Have you noticed the same in America and Canada?
This is my favorite question, and everyone always asks it, usually right away. What
I
I want to say to
apologize.
you, no, everyone has the same question. And so what I will say to you as a beginning answer to that question is that part of the reason the first year writing class exists is because in 1874, all of the faculty said that students couldn't write, that they were illiterate. And they had a long list. It's quite entertaining to read of all of the reasons that they said students couldn't write. Slang, reading novels is high on the list. They said reading novels is ruins students' ability to write. And there have been basically regular panics about student literacy and writing ever since then, kind of on a 10-year cycle. So in the US, there's a very famous Newsweek magazine cover in the 70s called Johnny Can't Write. And many people in my field recount stories of their deans calling them in and throwing the magazine down and saying, our students can't write. What are you going to do about it? So my answer to your question is that students are what they have always been, which is learners, and that all of us are learning to write in context that is always changing. And so I think part of what you're actually noting is that students may be struggling with longer form, formal texts in particular ways. And partially that may be shut down from COVID. Partially it may be that we live in a world that is lots of short texts. And they're really used, all of us now are getting used to just seeing things quickly and not spending extended time reading and writing. And then also, we live in a culture that's about accountability and testing. So I could talk about this forever because I think part of the challenge is that, especially in the US, I think Australia may be similar. We have been through a maybe 30-year cycle where we've been not trusting teachers and not trusting school and saying, you know, teachers need to be teaching to a test and we need to be assessing teachers and students based on the test. And so, how do you assess writing? You assess writing via these timed writing tests, which I'm going to say tell you nothing about anyone's ability to write. And so we have sort of a school system that's been responding to that and teaching students formulas and things that maybe are not what they need to know. And then you also have a culture in which we're doing lots of shorter form reading. But we also just have a long-standing history of panicking about student literacy. And I don't ever panic about it because I say students are learners and our job is to teach them. And that has not changed since 1874.
To riff off of that, you know, this short form, shorter form stuff. I mean, yeah, I advise companies on how to, you know, blog and all that sort of stuff. And yes, the days of a thousand word blog post are long gone. Now you're looking at 400, maybe 500 max words. But I mean, now, for example, with AI, my Gmail comes up with a little, do you want to rephrase this? And it'll rephrase the email that I write. And I don't know whether to be insulted or whether to be grateful for it to come up with a style that's different. What's your take on this whole AI encroaching into what was traditionally our skill base?
Well, again, I will say, as a scholar of writing, that we have a long, long, centuries-long history of new writing tools being introduced that completely change how we write. So if you think about the invention, initially people were sort of writing on tablets, on clay tablets with a stylus. There's no revision happening there. And then when they invented the pencil with an eraser, suddenly new things were available to people. And then, of course, the printing press, the word processor, all of these things, every time there was a crisis and people were panicking, AI is maybe a little bit more dramatic than some of those tools, although maybe the people who are writing on a clay tablet with a stylus would disagree with us. But I think that AI is a tool and that we will come to learn how to use it in really interesting ways. It doesn't think and it doesn't write. It appears to do those things, but it is not doing those things. And so I think it's really important for us to be teaching students about how to have AI literacy and how to recognize that if it's a tool, then you still need to be driving the car, right? You don't want to just turn it over to AI because it hallucinates, it makes things up, it steals things, it does all sorts of things you don't wish for it to do. But I think that, there's no way at this point to avoid it. Even at the example you gave is a good one. Grammarly is sort of in everything. And so I think that students do, all of us are going to need to learn how and when to use it, and also be thinking about things like the effects on the environment. And so is it worth, having it write this paragraph for you, given the amount of water and energy that it takes, that we need to be thinking about that. But I'm not afraid of what it's going to do. I have a lot of faith in human beings and our creative thinking and our need to use writing for learning. And in some ways, I have to say, as a faculty member who trains other faculty to use writing in their classrooms, it's really ushered in a new era. All kinds of faculty are coming to my workshops whom I never saw before. Because suddenly they have to think about writing. And they say, the essay I've been giving, now AI can write it. What do I do? And so that gives us the chance to say, what do you want students to learn? Why are you assigning writing at all? How do you want them to use writing? And it just invites them to rethink a relationship with writing that maybe they have never thought about before.
I mean, I use ProWriting Aid as my sort of editing tool, and yeah, that's now fully embedded with AI. I'm big on using AI to assist with the creative process, creative writing process. But it's interesting because of where I'm doing my master's at the moment in creative writing. They were extremely as Probably a lot of tertiary institutions were extremely anti-AI. Couldn't see the value in it. It wasn't real writing. There were a lot of pearl clutches amongst the people who were saying no, you should not use this. And as you quite rightly pointed out, it's been like seismic changes have been happening all the time. With the tablet, the quill, the word processor, the printing. It's always been change. I think AI is sort of like a big change, like the Gutenberg press sort of style or weight, but yeah, it's just a tool. And what I did find interesting is with Grammarly that you mentioned. I'm pretty sure. I'm confident that it was Grammarly who announced that they were going to create a checker for tertiary institutions, so you could see whether the writing was written by AI or not. Now, we all know that that's got a history of, like, what was it? The Declaration of Independence, I think, was one that was 99% sure was written by AI. I can't see these checkers keeping up with style, because you look at Claude. My favorite tool is Claude. It's now just released 3.7, and it's just beautiful prose. It knocks out. I don't see how any checker will be able to pick that in future iterations of Claude or GPT. But your view.
No, and they can't do it now. And so I strongly encourage our faculty not to even bother with that. I've been anti-Turnitin for a long time, even before AI. I think that A, our job is not to be policing, our job is to be teaching. I also think that EdTech will sell you almost anything. They can make up all sorts of technologies to solve a teaching problem that we did not actually even have.
And charge you a fortune for it.
And charge you a fortune for it while we're in, cost cutting mode. So, but the AI checkers are terrible. There's no point in actually spending money to use them. And so, what I say to every faculty member who comes to any workshop I lead is, think about what you want students to learn. Think about how to engage them in learning. Think about the role of writing in that learning, and keep them engaged. And then teach them to engage in the writing process, and then trust them because you're not the police. And so it's actually quite freeing, I think, to think about it like that, because it's my job to give you a learning environment that you want to be in, where you're learning something you're motivated to learn. But it's not my job to, spend all night trying to figure out if you used AI. And I will say, interesting maybe to you, is that part of my job is to run a center that includes a writing center, which has maybe what your listeners might best understand as tutors. So we have 35 to 40 undergraduate and graduate students who work for us, and they help students who come in or faculty who come in with their writing. And all fall, they all did research projects about AI because these tutors that we have were really interested in how students are using AI. And we just had a workshop last week where we asked the students to present to faculty and say, here's what we as students who just did research want you to know about AI. The number one thing they wanted faculty to do was talk to their students about AI and have a policy. That's it. So they said, my faculty often act like it's some sort of secret they don't want to discuss. They don't want to be bothered with it. They said, just tell us. Let's have a conversation about what you think AI can do, what you think it can't do, how you want us to use it. And they said, if the students are engaged and they understand what your policy is, we don't think that you'll have nearly the amount of trouble. They said students also are using AI when they don't understand the assignment. And so give a better assignment and tell them what your policy is, and then you will have far fewer problems and not really need the checker.
And the output will be much better. On the creative writing, and I appreciate that's not your sort of lane, but on the creative stuff, PseudoWrite, which is a tool that I use for writing creative stuff in books and novels, they just released a new engine, which is just leaps and bounds better than what they were using before, which was Claude. No, they weren't using bad stuff. But the latest, which is called Muse, MUSE, is pretty damn good. Now, one of the criticisms of AI by people who weren't on the bandwagon was that the copyright issue. That there was going to be a big copyright and it was going to come back and bite people on the bum. The thing about Muse is that he got writers, novelists, and creative writers involved from the very beginning. So they willingly, obviously, they were paid for it, but they were willingly giving their material to train Muse. So the copyright problem has gone. And I see that model moving across to the other main platforms as well. Is that something that crosses your mind that the copyright issue may well go away?
Well, you seem more optimistic than I feel about it. I think they've already stolen quite a lot of our work. I mean, just this past week, a lot of people in our field were saying, go look here and see how much of your work the AI engines have taken without your permission. And so I think the ship has sailed on that. And for that reason alone, I don't use AI the way that you just described because of concerns about copyright, privacy, intellectual property, and also surveillance and climate issues, but I think that the challenge is going to be, can our publishers come to some agreement with AI in a way that also serves their authors? And I think that's still up for debate. And I think one of the biggest challenges for us in my field, we really love open access. We've been trying very hard to produce things that are easily accessible to people. And now the result of that is that everything we wrote through open access has been scraped by AI and used to train AI, and none of us got anything for that. So that's a problem, but I don't know how you put the genie back in the bottle.
I mean, the pseudo right muse model is such that you own, you the writer, the creator, own the copyright, you own the IP. They don't have anything, but they've used some writers to train them, the LLM. Hopefully, yes. I mean, I am optimistic, so hopefully that will resolve itself. But yes, I mean, the genie is certainly out of the bottle, and there's no putting it back. And how, if I look at Amazon, because I mean, you publish through traditional publishers, so I publish through Amazon, because the royalties are a heck of a lot. You've got spread. I don't have spread at Amazon, but I got the royalties. So it's, it's a six of one, half dozen of the other. But even Amazon asks you to tick a box, and it won't let you not tick a box with saying, did AI help write this material? And if so, how much, and what level did you, did it knock out the whole thing, or did it chapters, or did it, you have to do lots of editing and all those sorts of questions. And I see that information being released into the public at some stage by Amazon, not necessarily with the author's permission, but I see that as being released. And the writing groups that I belong to, they're all going, no, we're not telling anyone that we're writing in AI, because the audience and the readers aren't ready for that. They think you just walk up to ChatGPT and say, write me a novel, or write me a book, and it spits out a book. And we both know that that's not how it works.
No.
No.
I am curious, given what we just said about the AI detectors really being basically worthless, is it's funny that Amazon's asking you that, because whether you say yes or no, how will they actually know?
Well, exactly right. But my fear is that they will publish it, even just with a little byline, tiny 8-point font or something, on their website, to say written with AI, or something like that. And certainly the where I'm doing my master's, they are very hot on the ethics of AI. So if you're writing stuff, not only do you have to, if you're submitting an assignment, you have to say, what prompt you used, and what the results were, but you also have to disclose if you have any written material, like you publish on Amazon or whatever, you have to say that it was co-written by AI. And it's just like, ooh, I don't know about that. And certainly the writing groups that I belong to, they go, nah, not doing that.
No, and also AI is not writing. It's stringing words together, but it's not writing. But yes, I see this is very interesting, and it is funny to hear you talk about being in a master's class, because I do think university faculty are not, on the cutting edge of this, especially those of us in English departments are. What my students are telling me, because I have students in the writing center from every division and every discipline, and they said, the people that are slowest to adopt and most suspicious are definitely the English faculty. So, I'd be curious to know, if that's also the case where you are.
Absolutely. I had a huge run-in with the faculty where I'm doing the course about AI, because they just did not understand it and were clutching their pearls and, saying, well, nowhere else will you get out. And if you go to another institution, like to do a doctorate or something, they said they won't accept AI. And it's kind of like, well, your boat has sailed on that. AI is out there. And as you say, the genie's not going back in the bottle. So you either come along and work out, and as you go, how to cope with AI in academia, or you just lose students because they won't get involved.
It's an issue, because I think this is maybe the first time in my entire academic career where I have seen that there's been something new that every single faculty member in the entire university basically needed to become acquainted with, if not an expert in, while also doing the job they already do. And so the question that we've had is, they can't just stop and all say, we're going to take 6 months off and go take some coursework in AI. They have to keep doing what they're doing. And so part of what we've been trying to do in our center is figure out how to give them some training and experience with AI. And one of the things that we've noticed is part of what we need to do is just force them to open it and use it. Because you think about it in your head too long, and you can really just
Oh, yeah,
spiral out of control.
absolutely. Yeah.
And so when they open it and see what it can do, and we have this sort of set of things we walk them through and say, try prompting this or try writing something and then ask it to do this. And I think that really helps them at the very least write a better policy, which is part of what we try to help them do is, you don't know what your policy is. So we're going to help you write one, but how can you have one if you don't understand what AI does? And you say no AI, well, it's in your Word. It's in, Grammarly is telling you what to do in your email. You can't not use it. So you need to get clear on what you mean when you say no AI. And the only way to do that is for you to actually, you don't ever have to use it again, but you do need to try it enough to say, okay, now I understand what it can do. And so that's the sort of training we've been trying to do for faculty because it's all new to them, and they're in the middle of teaching students like you who are coming in and saying, well, I've been using it. I feel like you're behind the times, and they're, sort of thrown back and trying to figure out what to do.
Interestingly enough, that I've had academics from other institutions privately contact me because I'm sort of known in the AI space, AI writing space, contact me and say, how do I do this? How do I write with AI that comes out with a credible output? But they're contacting me privately. They're saying, they're doing it on their home email rather than their work email.
That's funny.
So yeah, I mean, the interest is certainly there, but the institution that they belong to is somewhat conservative. So yeah, interesting.
And
So
it is interesting because
go on.
some institutions are super conservative, and then others are just going all in with no caution at all. So somebody had come and given a talk for us a couple weeks ago and said his university had just said, we're going to be the first AI powered university, and they just signed this multi-million dollar contract with an AI company. And he, was saying, this might not be wise. Maybe we want to talk about that first. So it seems like we're just all over the place. And it will, I it's going to take a while to stabilize, I think.
I saw a photo meme on Facebook the other day, which I thought was brilliant. And it was along the lines of what is happening with AI today? Where how big is AI in the world today? And the next image was of a bloke making a pitch to someone with a ballpoint pen saying, "This is powered by AI." So that's where the corporate world is at the moment. Everything is powered by AI, even pencils and pens. So yeah, I think we've got interesting times ahead of us.
We do. We do.
Can I segue to something completely different now? Because
Please.
well, otherwise it's going to become an AI fest and people are
All AI, yes.
news fest. Now you have come up with the, what's it called, sense making for student success. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Oh, sure. So one of the things that I've been very interested in is how you get groups of people, in my case, faculty, to really transform the culture and practice in the environment where they're working. And as we just discussed, faculty are often sort of cautious, conservative, slow to change. I think universities are very slow to change, but we know that we need to make change. And so one of the things I've seen happen again and again is either one of two things that universities say, we must change. We're going to hire a very expensive external consultant, probably one from the business world who sort of retooled for higher ed. Or they have said, faculty, we are about to totally eliminate your program. So you need to go off together and come back with some kind of new innovation. And I think both of those are utterly failing strategies. The external consultants don't know about teaching and learning. They don't know about students, and they're working in a for-profit environment. That is not our world. That's not our mission. Our mission is not to make money, it's to help students get an education. So they're not super helpful, although many people obviously disagree with me. And then you just can't easily send faculty off and say, go change. If they knew how to do that, they would have already done it. And as I like to say, faculty are treated and trained to be independent contractors, right? You are re rewarded only for your own personal research and how much you've done and your own teaching. And so then you say, get together with your colleagues and make something new. Everything in our culture has not taught us how to do that. And so I was reading a lot of change theory and doing a lot of faculty development programs and thought, I think that what we need here is some kind of method that takes what we know from change theory and then what we know from teaching and learning and creates a sort of scaffolded environment, kind of like a structured maybe sandbox where teams of faculty can get together and try to innovate something new, but they're not just thrown in there and told to do it. We have this scaffolded set of things that we walk them through. And that's quite different than what these external consultants do. They sort of come in with these PowerPoints that they have for everyone and say, you know, here's things you must do. But I think that the best, most innovative ideas are going to come up from the people who are sitting in classrooms with their students, who know their disciplinary material, but they are not trained or rewarded for doing that kind of curricular and program innovation. And so what we've been doing in the Howe Center for a number of years now, and then now across Ohio with my latest project, is just really trying this out, this what I've started calling a sense-making method. That's a term we took from Adriana Kezar, who's a change theorist. And the idea is that if you want deep change to happen, which is the kind of change to culture and thinking, which is quite different than first order change, which is a change to maybe a practice or a policy. But if you want deep change, then the people involved have to engage in sense making. And that really requires them to think together and actually change their mind about something. And so what I've been trying to do is create these sort of programs and a sort of a toolbox to help faculty get together in teams and take up these problems that they're facing. And so examples might be, you know, particular disciplines or majors are not attracting students anymore. And so we need to rethink how do we do this work, or do we need to do it across disciplines? Or we notice that we're not serving a particular kind of student, that they're failing out, they're not coming back. This happens a lot with STEM. So I have a lot of STEM faculty who say the first year in any kind of science, technology, engineering, math, they're failing out at an alarming rate. And so when I hear them say that, I think we have a problem with, you know, you can't blame the students. If there's something going on, you need to think, how has our environment created this? And so we've been helping them engage in these sense-making activities to sort of rethink, change their ideas about learning and teaching, and then make new programs that meet the current moment. And so thinking about what would student success look like if we could get faculty to do that work.
Totally with you on that. I have been working with organizations, you know, with introducing AI into the organization, and boy, does it shake up the culture. But one of the key things that I tell these CEOs and C-suites is that they have to form teams, but the teams that they form must have neurodiverse people as part of the mix, because the neurodiverse can see things that the neurotypical can't. But it's the things that they see, the neurodiverse see, that can transform and change things. But they're most likely, if they are in a team, they're most likely the ones who don't say anything. The highest paid person in the room is the one that says the most. And I get these CEOs to flip that and say, no, make sure that you're neurodiverse. Give their ideas, they share their ideas. Even if the idea is wrong, get them to get into a habit of sharing their ideas, because it's from them that you're going to have the ideas that take things forward, not business as usual.
Yeah, so what I would then add to that is to say, I might tell them something like that, but then the structures of their interactions are not set up to make that happen. And so part of what we try to do in a sense making event is to set things up totally different than normal. So I like to say meetings, committees, all of those things are very bad for any kind of sense making or innovation because you sit in a room and it happens exactly as you say. The person with the most power does all the talking and then you leave and nothing new has been discovered. And so what we try to do, I'll give you an example. So we had last year we had a retreat and I sent out in advance and said, what are the problems you think we need to work on? And then we created ideation stations. So when they came in, all of them visited each ideation station and wrote their ideas about the question. And they each went to every station. And then, when everybody had written and responded, they all did a gallery walk and read what every single other person had written. So it was impossible for one person to dominate because every single person had been able to contribute through writing. And then they formed teams around the one. The question that interested them the most based on what other people had said. And then we went on from there into more like design thinking. But I think that to overcome the problem you just named, we've got to bust up the way they usually interact with each other. And someone has to do it who's not a member of that group. And so you coming in is really important because the minute somebody who is an internal member leads the meeting or whatever you're doing, it just reverts to the same old ways of interacting. So you kind of have to have an external consultant, even if it's, in the university from a different department. So I like to tell people I can do this for all of them, but not my own department because they can't hear me and I'm way too involved in their daily their daily struggles. It has to be someone else.
Wasn't it something in the Bible that a prophet is unrespected in their own town or something
That's
along
it.
those
Yes.
lines? A question. About writers, I've written some questions for you. What do you believe are the most critical skills that a writer across any genre or discipline? What are those critical skills that they need to develop if they're going to have a long-term success, however you define it?
Well, I think the most important skill is to recognize the nature of writing and what it is that helps writers succeed. And that is that writing is about getting things done. Good writing is effective writing, and that all writers need time, practice, and feedback. And I think those are the things that enable them to be successful at whatever it is they're trying to do, whether they're writing a short story or, a PowerPoint or whatever the case may be, is that they tend to think about writing as correctness, not making mistakes, and something they can do quickly without error. And I think in order for them to be successful as writers, they have to put those ideas away and replace them with better ideas, because those bad ideas really get in the way of effective practice as a writer. So, I like to say that if you think that some people are just born good writers and other people are not, and that you're one of those people that was not born a good writer, why would you bother to try? Why would you make any effort? You're not going to write, you're not going to revise, you're just going to give up. And so, I think the most important, and I won't even call it a skill, I just think that the most important thing anyone can have to be a successful writer is to replace their bad ideas about writing with healthy ones so that they can engage with all the things that we know effective writers do.
I can't remember the writer who said it, but they said writing is really easy. All you do is stare at the blank page until your forehead bleeds.
Yes, I'm against bleeding, but I agree that it takes time. And I think the problem is, people tell me all sorts of things about writing when they find out what I do for a living. And most of the things they tell me are really sad. They have a lot of very bad experiences with writing starting in school. People say terrible things to them, give them lots of awful feedback, do lots of line editing. many people have had used writing have had writing used as punishment. You know, like you've talked too much in class, now you're going to write an essay or write on the board again and again, right? We've done a woman in my field did a study on this, and you know, many people had such painful memories to share. And so I just think that, you know, one of the most important things we could do as university faculty who teach writing is to help people replace those ideas with healthy ones. And then they can do all sorts of things. And maybe they will never be a novelist, but they might write really excellent memos to their boss or be able to make a case for themselves when their landlord raises the rent. You know, all of those things are done with writing. And if people think that they can't write or they're not writers, then they won't even try to engage in those.
I mean, you would have come across and read a bucket load of material. For you, any genre, it doesn't matter, any genre. What makes, why is one book successful and another book about the same topic just not successful in the slightest? Why do some go for edition after edition after edition, endlessly, like textbooks, for example? Or why does someone release a book and it just disappears? Well, what's the difference between the two?
Well, I think, Lee, if we knew the answer to that, we would both be millionaires. I don't know the answer to that. I just think it's such an interesting question. And I know this is not what you asked me, but I often, when I'm trying to get people to change their ideas about writing, one of the things I ask them to do is say, what was the last thing that you read that you said to someone else? You just have to read this. It was the best thing. And then why did you suggest it to them? And of course, they never say because it was full of correct and complete sentences. That's not why things are successful or memorable for us. But then what else does it, you know, is it that makes them successful? I mean, I don't know, but I mean, when I met Ruth, I think I was probably giving the talk I love to give, which is that writing mediates activity. And we use writing and like writing and respond to writing if it gets something done for us. And so, the case of books that are really successful, obviously, people who are reading it are finding that it is really mediating some important activity for them in a way that some other book is not. And sometimes I'm going to guess that that's about marketing, you know, that it didn't find a readership because the marketing wasn't good. But sometimes there's just something else, and I wish I knew what it was.
I mean, it reminds me of the Da Vinci Code. Now, there was very little marketing at first for the Da Vinci Code, and his novels before the Da Vinci Code were, let's be generous and say, average. The Da Vinci Code, academics and critics, I just panned it. They hated it, same as the 50 Shades. But boy, did it sell by the bucket load. So what was it that made these authors billionaires, if not millionaires, and other books just and yes, if we had the I'm going to ask Chat GPT later on, see what it comes up with.
Good. Yes. Ask it what it thinks. Yeah. But I do think that's interesting. And it's why I don't study creative writing. And what I constantly am saying to people is think carefully about what you say makes something a good piece of writing. Because it's not, you know, the sort of pretentious academic idea about good writing, which is basically that it's long form, fancy, you know, whatever prose that may be good writing in a very specific context. But what makes writing good in most contexts is, does it speak to you? Does it meet you where you are? Does it accomplish the thing you need it to accomplish? And I mean, I love talking about grocery lists as an example of writing that are really interesting in that regard. Is you write a grocery list because there's something you need to do. And you know that if you write a bad one, you go from aisle to aisle and you have to go, you know, go back. Nobody probably taught you to do that, but you improve it over time because you need to be more efficient or, you know, whatever your reasoning is. And that's a really important piece of writing that mediates activity in the world. And so I love to think about the humble genres, not just the, you know, famous creative genres, but those humble genres that get our work done for us every day in our lives. And I think that's why so many people who don't see themselves as writers could be invited into thinking about that if we could help them recognize all the ways they do use writing every day, like the grocery list.
I am so going to use that grocery list because that's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And you can use it in any context. You could use it. Okay, what if I'm in the work environment, for example, the corporate environment, what can I, as a, I need to get a memo to the CEO, or I need talking points for a presentation by our sales team. What grocery list can I put together that will be memorable so they can remember it? It's in the correct order rather than them going back and forth all over the place, and delivers exactly the outcome that we're looking for. I love that. Thank you very much. I'm going to steal that one.
You're welcome. And we could keep going. I mean, I love to talk about the grocery list because it's also an example of how we give a name to a genre that in actual practice looks all kinds of ways. And so I actually do this where I make p everybody in the group bring in their grocery list, and they are all over the place. And so mine is usually scrawled on my hand, and then I wipe it off by accident. But Mandy, who works for me, has spreadsheets, and she has grocery lists for different groceries to see where what's cheaper, and then she tracks the pricing. And then I know somebody else who does his by meal, right? And so he comes in every Sunday and he's shopping by meal. And I think that it's a very interesting way to help people recognize that when you're learning to write a new genre, that what you learned before might not serve you in the new setting. So if you've written a report at one kind of in for one kind of employer, and then you go to another one, they might use the word report, but they mean something quite different. And that it came into those genre conventions because there are things that need to happen in that environment. So just as we make our grocery list do whatever it is that we need to do, so in Mandy's case, save money, in Adam's case, it's because he needs the meals, exactly right every day. The genre conventions are helping us get those things done. And that's a way more interesting way to learn how to write a new genre than to say, oh, there must be rigid rules and now I need to learn them. They come into being to help us get something done, and then they change.
When I was on my beginning my journey in terms of writing, which was even before the internet back in the 90s, I bought, as one does over the years, a large number of books about grammar and the punctuation and all that sort of stuff. And I've never read them because you get about like even half a chapter in and you go, yeah, but that's soulless. What you're writing is just soulless. There's no, I love sentences that are short and sharp and just like miss out half the words that you could use as fillers. And it's just bang, it's there to punctuate in between longer sentences that are more descriptive. But that's just wrong as far as the grammaticians are concerned.
Yeah, well, I agree with you on that completely. I think that the way we, first of all, there's not one grammar, there's many grammars, and as there are many, dialects, and they're all correct. They are different, and so I don't think that there's a, people need to learn to use grammar in order to convey their message. But there is no perfect or right way. And this is another place that the grocery list is a fantastic example, because in the new book that I have coming out with Wiley in the fall, there is a whole example in here that when you write your grocery list in paragraph form, in perfect complete sentences, you can't use it. It does not help you. And so, what is correct really depends on what it is that you're trying to accomplish. And so, I on the plane, I never like to tell people what I do, because then they say, oh, my grammar, I'm so worried you'll judge me. And I want to say, I'm not even interested in that. I want to know how you use language to get things done. And if you're using it effectively to communicate, then it's working, right? And so those books are an interesting genre that I assume some people find useful, but I do not.
I remember a number of them saying, words along the line of, if you don't do proper grammar, then you're never going to be successful. To which I always think E.E. Cummings.
Yeah. Yes. You can automatically think of all the reasons why that statement is incorrect.
Tell us more then, because this book coming out in September. Tell us more with the premise behind it, and also sneak us some key ideas from it in advance of publication.
Sure. It's coming out in September from Wiley, and it's called Writing Rediscovered: Nine Concepts to Transform Your Relationship with Writing. And if you've been talking to me today, you probably get a sense already of what it's about. But for many years, as you know, I've been thinking about how do you help people change their ideas about writing. I've done that in textbook form. We also have an online writing institute where we've done a similar thing. But the idea here is that everyday people in the world really deserve the opportunity to rethink what writing is and what their relationship with writing is in order to be more effective writers. And so it's around the idea of threshold concepts, that there are sort of nine transformational concepts about writing that will help you think differently and thus do different things. And so it's all little bite-sized pieces. So I try to say it's something you should sip, not gulp, right? The idea that you sort of work your way through the nine concepts and then go off in your life after each one and sort of try them out and see if what you do changes if you can change your thinking about writing.
I'm going to throw something controversial in on that
Okay.
point.
Great.
One thing that I've noticed with American academics versus, say, European or British academics and Australian academics is that if you read an American textbook or American sort of intellectual book, you get to about chapter five, chapter six, maybe chapter seven, and you go, hang on a second, you've brought this point up three times. You're just saying it in different ways. Are you trying to fill in a number of words for the contract? And I just, yeah. So to put you on the spot, are you working to that model? And I hope not. And I don't think you do, because the way you've explained it, it's kind of not repeating everything just to make the word count. But do you know fellow academics who do that?
No. I actually don't think anyone's trying to fill a word count. Usually we're getting told we've said too many words, written too many words. I actually think it's probably an editor problem that people are actually could maybe have learned to say it more briefly, or you've said it once, that might be enough.
Yeah.
And academics are just trained to, go on and on. So I am definitely not doing that in this new book. It is not for academics. It's very short, and in fact, the editor came back to me a couple times and said, "Why don't you add a little more?" And I thought, "Oh, well, I don't want people to get bored and walk away." And he said, No. I think that they would like to know more. Maybe tell them a little more." Because I just thought, you get it, and then you can move on. You don't need to belabor the point.
It's interesting. I'm seeing a trend coming, and perhaps this is because of AI, I don't know, or it just be people's attention spans. But the size, the word counts of books are coming down. Whereas, you used to get the 80,000 word tome. Now it's coming down to 60 to 50, sometimes even to 40,000 words. Are you seeing that in America?
I have not thought about that. I have not seen that. I think the bigger problem is that we're losing a lot of presses.
Yeah.
That seems to be the bigger challenge, is that the publishing industry, I think, is just in a real crisis, which
Yeah.
might be related to the word count issue.
Oh, look, I mean, we're the same in Australia. We've got a publisher crisis as well. Yeah, they're all the independent ones are all disappearing, or they're being snapped up by the big ones. But what worries me about the big ones is that I've had some anecdotal, I agree, evidence that some of the big publishing houses are getting AI, and they're running it through, an engine a number of times before they release it. But they're using AI to write books, so they don't have to pay any authors.
Oh, that's bad.
Yeah, but it's not talked about, but yeah, so it's a worry if they are doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope not. Hasn't happened to me yet. We'll see.
Oh, well, fingers crossed then. Okay, let's try another question. If you've got writer's block, which happens to the best of us, how do you get over writer's block?
I think it depends on the cause of your writer's block. So, is it actually like a medical writer's block, that you are having real psychological anxieties that are keeping you from writing, or are you simply stuck? Right? Because I think those do take different responses. So let's go with the you're just stuck kind of thing. I think that there's a lot of things that you can do, and I talk about a couple of them in the book. And one is to just set aside the idea that what you have to do to write is actually sit at your computer and type. You don't have to do that. But what if you tried a voice memo instead? What if you tried paper and pencil? What if you took a walk and then just had your phone out and talked at it? One of the things we try in our writing center when students come in and say they're blocked is say, okay, I will sit here and just write down everything you say to me. So go ahead and try to get your ideas out and I'll write them down and give them back to you. So I think that one of the things to help people who feel stuck is just to recognize that there's a lot of ways that you can get words on a page, and they do not have to always entail you just staring at the page and, as you said earlier, beating your head against it until you're bloody. It shouldn't be that painful. And so this does relate to actually one of the other ideas about writing that I think is really important, which is that writing is social and that you do not have to write alone. You're always writing with words that you inherited from someone else. But in addition to that, you're always writing to someone, and you can write with someone. And that might be incredibly helpful for you to sort of get out of your own head, and into another way to get your ideas out.
And one a fellow writer who was on a previous episode of this podcast said that he loves going down to the local cafe. He'll stick his noise, headphones on, but he loves going down the cafe because he sees all these people. He sees the interactions. He sees people smiling to each other, and that helps get him to be inspired to get words on the screen, and. Yeah, I mean it's and you that idea of that you said about just talking into your phone, about anything, shopping list, whatever, but just to get words flowing, and over time those words will start to coalesce into something that you can then use as a jumping point to get you back off the block that you're in.
And I think it's useful for people to know that every writer is different. And if the way that you were taught to write something in school is not working for you, that doesn't mean you're a bad writer, that you may need to try to write in a different way. And so I have a friend who almost doesn't write a single word for months, but it's all happening in her brain. So she's reading, she's thinking, and she can hold a lot of it in her head. And then when she's finally ready, it all sort of comes out. And I think a lot of people would say, oh, she writes really quickly. No, she writes very slowly. It's happening in a way that you can't see. And some writers just really need that oral piece. They need to talk it out. Some people must have a pen and paper because something different happens when their hand is actually moving. And so I often, and at the end of the book, encourage people to try a bunch of different things and then see what works for them. And try them all once, right? And then just say to yourself, okay, here's my writer's toolbox. Here are the things that help me. Here are the things that definitely don't help me. So some people have to write around other people, as your friend at the cafe. Some people can't write with any noise at all. And so you just need to learn what it is that works for you. And I think that a lot of times when people come out of school and say, I can't write, I think what they mean is the tools that were given to me in school are not working for me. And then they need to know that they have permission to try a bunch of other things.
And you can take that concept across to other points of your learning journey, in that you as an individual, you have different styles, you have different things that you like, that you resonate with, in the writing world, that don't necessarily work for the person next to you. So I've been drummed in from school days that I'm supposed to love the bard, but I can't get into his stuff at all. And I pick it up and I get half a page in, and I'm going, I don't understand this. Now, I don't know whether that's my neurodiverse brain or whether it's just that he's incomprehensible. And so people go, oh, yes, the bard, having never read it.
Right. Well, and again, he wrote to be performed. And so reading the plays is painful That's because it was supposed to be performed. And also, we don't use that kind of English anymore. And so, when I go to our Cincinnati Shakespeare Theater and see Shakespeare performed, I thoroughly enjoy it. But when I try to read it, it's super painful. And so I think we all need to recognize that just because we're told that something is supposed to work or be good or meaningful for us doesn't mean that we need to accept that. And unfortunately, when it comes to writing and in the case you've explained, reading, I think people just feel maybe ashamed to say, that doesn't work for me, or I didn't understand that. And that's really unfortunate because we won't get better and we won't be able to try new things if we can't admit that didn't work for me for some reason.
My local bookshop has a wonderful stand, a table with a sign on it saying, these are the books that you t say you've read that you've ever actually read. Come and buy one. Yeah, the concept, oh yeah, it is. I've read War and Peace. Yes, I've read Fahrenheit 451 and Catch 22, and now I haven't, but I'll go and buy them. So they sit in my bookshelf, never open. But they sit in my bookshelf. So I'm obviously a literate person, so yeah, I think there's that some of that as well. I'm conscious that you have got things to do, and I know Ruth's got things to do, and Ruth has been very quiet and not sort of said anything, even though I've seen her put her hand up a couple of times saying, "I want to say something." But Ruth, your next cab off the rank for the next episode of this podcast. What are we going to be talking about?
Well, we've learned from Liz Wardle how to name what is called a threshold concept, which we have done so in our book coming out May 6th called The Motivated Speaker. So we've taken her brilliant expertise, mentoring, and friendship, and turned it into a guide for speakers in defining, or at least naming, organizing, I should say, what you need to understand in order to be a great communicator. So, what you need to understand while speaking. Most people can speak. The question is, how can you speak well? Liz has helped us to really solidify that our practice is in coaching speakers. Our curiosity was, how can we do better for them? And this book is the answer to that question. So that's what we'll be doing next. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, which is why I didn't interrupt. And I could listen to Liz all day long.
Oh,
I want to know when you raised your hand, though, because I was
I
trying
don't
not to
think I
look
did.
at you.
I think I scratched my I think I
Okay,
scratched.
okay.
I don't think it was like
Oh,
I took a few notes.
I thought you were going to rip into her and say, "I utterly, you are so wrong, Liz, so wrong." But that obviously,
Oh my
no,
gosh, there are many things that I would say to Liz Wardle that is not one of them.
Liz, we're coming to the end. I would love it if you've got some sort of advice or something to say, not just to the creative writers, but to any writer of shopping lists or whatever. What words of wisdom can you pass? Because I'm sure it's going to be words of wisdom. It's not going to be fluff. But what words of wisdom can you pass on to a baton you can pass on, as it were, to writers?
That's a high bar you've just set.
How
Okay.
about this? How about make sure to draw the kind of potato you want? Just don't write it out. I love that example. Is it a red potato, a yellow potato?
Yes, I gave Ruth some examples in a talk I gave of a woman on the internet who wrote a grocery list for her husband and then drew examples of what the potatoes look like that she wanted him to come home with.
Very wise,
In case
yes.
he had apparently never seen a medium-sized potato before. So my main advice is actually maybe to a broader audience, especially to people who may not even think of themselves as writers, to say you are a writer because you use writing all the time in your daily life, and you should recognize that the things that you write have value, even if they are not published and they're not called, literature, that they have value, and that that's what makes the world go round is the kinds of writing that you do. And that you should see yourself as a writer and recognize that writing is hard for everyone. So don't be ashamed if it's hard for you, and that it takes time and practice and feedback, and that is true forever. So you will never stop needing to learn new things about writing. And that is true for me. It is true for Ruth. It is true for you, especially when you try to write something new that you haven't written before. And so embrace that and call yourself a writer and really explore all of the ways that you can use writing to mediate the activities of your life.
And on that point of, it's a lifelong journey. It's not just a one-off. When I was 63 years of age, just a few years ago, and I was at the beginning of this master's course that I'm doing, it suddenly I realized, because I was doing, quite well with the assignments, and it suddenly occurred to me, I'm actually a writer. I'm a creative. And I never knew that before. And suddenly recognizing that you're creative made the world, it's totally understandable why I hated the corporate world, why I kept failing at various things, because that's just square peg in a round hole. And so, it's now that I'm thoroughly enjoying writing, creating stuff and business stuff. And, I just love it. And I think that anyone who picks up a pen or, Evernote or their word processor and just starts writing shopping lists, they will hopefully over time come to love creating, even if it's a business document, but creating something and passing it on. Your views?
I love that story, and I love the way that you've used the word creator there because I think that people are not only afraid to use the word writer, but I think they're definitely afraid to use the word creator. And so helping them recognize all of the ways that they're using language and symbols to communicate, and that they're doing that by creating something new, whether it's a shopping list or a memo or a novel, is a really important way of making meaning in the world, and that every one of us can do that and has the right to call ourselves that. And I think that's probably very freeing for most people. There are not a lot of people in the world who call themselves writers or creators, but thinking about that, I think, is important and also a really nice way to end this conversation, which a large part of which was about AI. AI is not a writer, it is not a creator. And it is not thinking. And so it's a tool for us, but we are the ones who have those abilities, and we should really embrace those.
Yeah, totally agree with you. Although, with the last iteration of ChatGPT, the 0.1 model, when they leapt up from 4, it is a thinking machine now. It can show the thinking. DeepSeek, the Chinese one, also shows you its thinking. So I maybe 18 months, 2 years, we will have AI models that can take a concept and extrapolate from the data that it's got, and not only just punch out what it's got before, but actually take it to the next step. And that's going to be fascinating, I think, in 18 months, 2 years' time.
If by fascinating you mean terrifying, then perhaps. But also, I would remind us all that AI can only do what it's doing because it's trained on all of our work. And I literally mean our work, my work, your work. And so it is not doing that without human intervention. And so I just hope that we all remember that we are writers, we are creators, and we should not be looking to machines to do that for us if they are tools and they are partners. And that, that's something we want to explore, that's fine, but they are not, we shouldn't be asking them to think for us.
Fair enough too. Yeah, I mean, we hold on to the they may create a book outline, but we're the ones who say, actually, no, I want this in this chapter, which you have left out, but I think it's important to put this concept in. And then, yeah, we have to edit and we have to change and we have to manipulate the output until we've got something that we're comfortable with and proud to release. So yeah, I totally agree. Liz, would you be happy to come back once your new book, your forthcoming book is released? Because I'd love to talk about that on a separate podcast. Would you be acceptable or comfortable with that?
I would be delighted, absolutely.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ruth, yeah, we've got next week we're going to sit, and again, just like I've done with Elizabeth, I will make you bleed from your forehead and sweat like nothing on earth with the creative and cruel questions that I have for you.
Yes, it's been
I
terrifying.
look forward to. I'm terrified, very terrified.
Excellent. Well, thank
I
you
look
so
forward.
much.
At least this gave me a sense of how deep the cuts will be. So I'll be.
Was it Rod Stewart? The first cut is the deepest, or something.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Thank you, both of you. Thank you so much. And Liz, yeah, we'll catch up when your book's released, because I'd love to talk about that as well. Thank you both so much for being part of this podcast today, and let's catch up again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you
Thanks.
so much. I
Thanks,
appreciate it.
Liz. Thanks, Lee.